podcast is part of the Bomb Pod Media Network.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I think the whole problem with the Patterson's case is that from the very beginning, the investigation was botched. And so time was lost. It took several months for the disappearance report to be filed. So we can only speculate about what police would have done if he had spoken back then in the early stages of the investigation. You know, it would just be speculation. It was not a very tight investigation. I think they really just thought, police must have thought at the beginning they were dealing with the missing couple. If something happened, they took off, but that they would reappear somewhere else later in time.
El Paso, short for El Paso del Norte, which is Spanish for the Pass of the North, rests in the far western corner of Texas. The dusty city sits on the Rio Grande River, just across the border from Juarez, Mexico. Rich in history, the Mexican and Texan government grappled for its control until Texas irrevocably took hold in 1846. The early 1880s brought the railroads into the desert town, and it was recorded a mere 736 residents lived in the county seat. Industry and mining began transforming the city at the turn of the century, and the start of an economic boom took place in the 1920s, due in part to major business developments. The Great Depression hit the city hard. Its population dwindled as families moved to larger cities looking for work. The United States Army Post, Fort Bliss, was founded in El Paso in 1854. By 1941, the installation was the largest cavalry post in the nation and is now the second largest military installation in the United States. Military expansion, oil discoveries, and copper smelting created a rapid economic expansion on the cusp of the mid-20th century. With the boom came the proliferation of low-wage industries, which once again drove families to other cities in search for better-paying jobs. Cheap labor was difficult to come by, and from 1942 to 1956, the U.S. enacted the Bracero program, which brought cheap labor from Mexico to fill the labor needs, and the border town of El Paso took full advantage. By 1950, the bustling little city, nestled into the base of the Franklin Mountain Range, had reached a population of 130,000. El Paso has continued to grow year by year, as has its folklore, legends, and mysteries. Local legends, including La Llorona, the Juan de Oñate hidden treasure, the underground tunnels that honeycomb the town, the witch house on Scenic Drive, and the peculiar disappearance of William and Margaret Patterson have all continued to captivate the residents of El Paso for decades. For the past 60 years, the 1957 vanishing of the Pattersons has caused speculation ranging from kidnapping to murder, alien abduction to espionage. While much is unknown about what happened to the couple, the mysterious circumstances surrounding the event are still talked about today. William Durrell Patterson was born July 23, 1904, in Chicago, Illinois. He was the oldest child and only son of the five children born to Luther Melville Patterson, a traveling salesman from Kansas, and Marguerite Ann France, a housewife and Illinois native. William, who most often went by the nickname Pat, grew up in a two-story home in the small suburb of Maywood, located in Proviso Township. In this lower-income neighborhood, William learned at an early age to be a fast talker with an even faster swinging fist. At age 15, William started working in a factory making cabinets. He left home at age 16 and landed a job as a carny, touring the country and fast-talking the crowds into dropping their nickels on the near-impossible-to-win carnival games. Working as a barker for several different circuses, the silver-tongued young man easily convinced the country folk that the exhibits were something they couldn't live without seeing for themselves. William rarely wrote his family as he wandered the country. While in Georgia, William was picked up for vagrancy. Using his skills of articulate persuasion, he convinced the judge to set him free. The magistrate was no match for William's tales of struggles and trials and tribulations. The judge felt so moved, in fact, that he gave William a few bucks before sending the hapless youth on his way. Soon after, the judge caught William taking a swim in a pool, relaxed and seemingly without a care in the world. Feeling deceived, the judge sentenced him to 30 days on the Georgia chain gang. William would later say that working on the chain gang was the most educational experience he'd ever had. He eventually landed work as a traveling product demonstrator for a chemical company, which led the young man to concoct his own spot remover by mixing soap flakes with other chemicals. William successfully peddled his miracle cleaner all over the Midwest. He was a born salesman and was proud of his ability to take care of himself by hawking gimmicks and novelties on street corners, stores, and carnivals all over the country. William seemed to prefer jobs that were easy to come by and hard to track. As fate would have it, William's travels led him to the Hotel Vendome coffee shop in Evansville, Indiana, where a very attractive, red-headed hostess named Margaret greeted him. Margaret Matilda Kiefer was born December 29, 1905, to German-born John Jacob Kiefer and Kentucky native Mary Josephine O'Brien. Margaret, or Tilly, as her family called her, was born and grew up on the O'Brien's farm in Curdsville, Kentucky. She was the fifth Kiefer child to be born on the farm. Margaret's family was large. She had five sisters and three brothers. The O'Brien's farm, which grew corn and raised hogs, had been in her mother's family for several generations. Never satisfied with the country life, Margaret daydreamed about something bigger and better. She left home at an early age, setting out for the city to seek her fortune. A couple that rented to Margaret in Evansville later described her as a real beauty, who often wore clothes she could not have afforded. On June 21, 1933, Margaret Kiefer and William Patterson obtained a marriage license in Franklin County, Ohio. Margaret was 27 and only 7 months younger than William, but lied on the marriage application, stating that she was only 23. Sometime after marrying William, Margaret cut off all ties with her family. She apparently told friends that she was given an ultimatum by her family to choose them or William, and, backfiring as ultimatums often do, she chose William. Like Margaret, William always dreamed of a bigger and better life. The couple kicked around the country for many years as William taught Margaret the tricks of the trade of being a pitchman, a person that solicited goods with gusto and often promises of life-altering experiences at the hands of the miracle product they peddled. It is said Margaret turned out to be quite the pitchman herself. William began promoting and selling a reflex-type camera sometime in the 1930s, and learning the ins and outs of photography in the process. The Pattersons moved to Dallas, and William tried to make a living as a kidnapper, a term used by pitchmen that meant sidewalk photographer. He wasn't too successful, so the couple decided to pick up and move west to El Paso in 1940 to try their luck there. Things didn't improve much for the first 3 years in the West Texas town. By 1942, with World War II raging, the Pattersons were living in a broken-down house trailer with two cats and a dog. Their total net worth was $35. It was also during this time that William, who often made trips across the border, began getting a taste of the good life he'd so desperately wanted. During the war, women's nylon stockings were a precious commodity. All available nylon and silk were being used to make parachutes and tents, and the production of the materials was reserved solely for the war effort. Women flooded the stores, bought up, and hoarded all available stockings, creating a shortage and inflation in price. William began selling nylon stockings on the black market, smuggling them in from Mexico. It is said he made quite a substantial profit doing this. William began hiring employees to kidnap for him, dressing them in all-white uniforms with the word Hollywood embroidered on their caps. He purchased a shiny new Pontiac and was able to rent a cubbyhole-sized office where he sold photo supplies. In 1944, however, the Pattersons' luck finally began to change when William persuaded a lender to put up a small loan with no collateral. He and Margaret opened Patterson Photo Supply, located at 3815 Alameda Avenue in the Caples Building, but still what you'd call a hole in the wall. While William ran the photo supply store, Margaret handled the financial end. Margaret was known to keep a tight grip on the purse strings as their business began to grow. In 1947, the Pattersons purchased a home at 3000 Piedmont Drive, which nestled into the foothills of the Franklin Mountains. By 1950, business was booming, and the couple moved their store to 113 North Main Street in downtown El Paso, a much larger space. The Pattersons were doing well and living it up. They were flaunting their success with expensive diamond rings and fancy watches. Though William did not carry a lot of cash on him, he loved to flash $100 bills. William bought Margaret two expensive mink coats, which were stolen in 51. One was later recovered in New Mexico, and the other was never found. By the mid-50s, the Pattersons Photo Supply Company was doing over $350,000 in business, which would equate to over an astounding $3.2 million in today's money. This afforded the Pattersons with property in Guaymas, Mexico, a boat, a brand new 1956 Cadillac, a new Volkswagen Carmen Ghia, several lots of land around El Paso, a nice house trailer, interest in a high-end boat company, and expensive fishing tackle. William was said to have been a master fisherman. He often went on fishing trips to Mexico, Florida, and the West Coast. Well established into the community, the Pattersons were doing well for themselves. Friends reported that William was a man who wanted only the best in life. He was known for his nice clothes and expensive jewelry. He was trying to make up for the years growing up when he didn't have anything, they supposed. Though generally a good guy, his friends declared, William was also a braggart. He was flashy and liked to boast about his good fortunes to anyone who would give him the time to do so. But for all of their extravagance and William's $200 suits, they lived a quiet and reserved life. They were well-liked by those who knew them and had many friends. Neighbors observed visitors at the Patterson home often. They did not have children and continued to say little about their lives before moving to El Paso. Those closest to the Pattersons, who thought they knew the couple inside and out, realized later that they really didn't know them well at all. They'd been left in the dark about so many details that friends usually share with one another. Margaret's friends would later state that she'd never told them specifics about her childhood, even where she was from, when her birthday was, or how she and William met. If and when William talked about his boyhood, he indicated that it was full of hard knocks and left it at that. Among the Pattersons' list of closest friends were Tessie and Cecil Ward, who owned and operated the Ward Motor Clinic in El Paso since 1946 and is still in business today, though Cecil and Tessie have passed. Nathan Diamond, longtime fishing buddy of William's and owner of Diamond's Dry Cleaning in El Paso. Associates of William and Margaret Patterson include Art Moreno. Art was a young employee who had worked at Patterson's Photo Supply for 7 years and, by all indications, something of an apprentice to William, who was teaching him how to run the business as the store's manager. Duffy Sasser, who owned a very successful photo finishing service that began in Clovis, New Mexico, as Fox Photo and was eventually named Duffy's Photo Service. Since photographic materials were rationed or taken during World War II, Sasser and wife Vivian decided they'd meet the demands at home for the photography industry and set up a small dark room in their house. They used surplus and scrap film ends from the nearby airbase, mixed their own chemicals, and wound hand-cut strips of film onto spools. Duffy and Vivian Sasser developed pictures for the customers of camera shops and drug stores around eastern New Mexico. Even after the war, the business flourished and expanded into multiple photo processing locations, including El Paso, Texas. Retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Daniel Gray Kirkland, also known as D.G. Kirkland or Kirk, managed Duffy's photo processing facility in Lubbock, Texas. This location was the company's headquarters. In some capacity, Kirkland oversaw at least the business aspect of Duffy's branch in El Paso, having moved to the West Texas city in 1955 when it opened, and was introduced to the Pattersons through Duffy. Herbert Roth was an accounts manager, assistant credit manager, and office manager for the auditing firm Buckner and Bimark. He'd been the Pattersons' accountant for 8 years. Both Roth and his wife, Jenny, were originally from New Jersey and had been in El Paso for 24 years. Doyle Riley of Albuquerque, New Mexico, not only worked for the company that supplied Patterson's Photo Supply with products, but was also a longtime and trusted friend of William's. On Monday, March 4th, 1957, Cecil and Tessie Ward joined the Pattersons at their home for a quiet get-together. William and Cecil retreated to the garage after dining to work on the 18-foot boat William had been fixing up. They used Cecil's electric sander to smooth the wood before applying a coat of acrylic paint. Tessie and Margaret sat in the living room chatting. Tessie insisted on helping Margaret clean up the dinner mess, but Margaret refused, opting to sit and visit instead. When William and Cecil called it quits for the night, they brought the electric sander into the house for safekeeping. The two made plans to continue fixing up the boat most evenings that week. He talked about what we would do on the boat the other nights during the week and about plans for fishing and doing a lot of other things in the spring and summer, Cecil later told the El Paso Herald-Post. According to Cecil, on Tuesday, March 5th, at approximately 2 p.m., Pat and Margaret stopped by the Ward Motor Clinic in their Cadillac and asked him to check out the air cooler at their residence. Cecil drove to the residence, checked the air cooler, and returned to the garage at 4:30 p.m. Though they'd planned to meet that evening to work on the boat, Cecil said he was feeling under the weather and couldn't make it. The following morning, at about 7:15 a.m., Wednesday, March 6th, 1957, a mechanic by the name of Nicholas Alvarez unlocked the garage and opened Ward Motor Clinic for business. A dark-complected man pulled in the driveway in the Patterson's Cadillac. Not recognizing the man, Alvarez watched the stranger park the car and exit. Waiting was another man who'd been trailing the stranger in Patterson's Cadillac, driving a tan 1953 or 1954 Chevrolet. The Cadillac driver climbed into the Chevrolet's passenger side, and the men drove off without explanation. It is certain that neither of these men were William Patterson. D.G. Kirkland entered the Ward Motor Clinic at 8 a.m. to instruct Cecil Ward to fix a few issues the car was having. Cecil asked him what he was doing handling the Cadillac, but Kirkland brushed him off, telling him that he'd been to the Pattersons the evening before, helping with the boat, and that they were going on a little vacation. Kirkland told Cecil that William had called him and said that he left the Cadillac at the motor clinic and wanted it serviced. The horn ring was broken, and he wanted the car cleaned. The car key was in the glove compartment, and Kirkland also said that William requested he retrieve the keys to Patterson's photo supply, which were attached to the vehicle's key, out of the glove compartment as well. Nothing was out of the ordinary the afternoon prior when he'd seen him, Cecil said, and neither William nor Margaret mentioned leaving town at all. Margaret never mentioned anything about plans for a trip, Tessie Ward told the paper. They drove by the motor clinic and talked to us. They said nothing about plans to go away, she added. It wasn't unusual for William and Margaret to travel or have their employees handle their affairs when they traveled, so the Wards didn't think too much about it. On Friday, March 8th, Cecil called Patterson Photo Supply and asked an employee to go pick up the electric sander he'd left at the Patterson's home and bring it to his shop. Not long after, Kirkland showed up with the sander. The employees at the photo shop were instructed to tell anyone who inquired about the Patterson's whereabouts or called to speak with them that the couple was on vacation. Margaret and William often vacationed for extended periods without informing anyone of their exact whereabouts or how to reach them. On March 15th, William's accountant, Herbert Roth, received a telegram from Dallas, signed only Pat, William's nickname. It read,
"Sorry to have to leave so sudden. Sell house trailer and use money for business. License both cars for business. Tell Art to cancel DC reservation and take care of business like it was his, as part will be someday. Put Kirkland in complete charge at same salary Duffy pays him. Work with both of them. Tell Kirkland to rent house for 9 months at least. Handle all this as quietly as possible. Important. Sure you will understand. Pat."
The Patterson's absence wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary. To those outside of the couple's innermost circle, and even some within, nothing appeared amiss. That is, until Tommy showed up. Margaret, friends say, loved Tommy more than anything on earth. It was reported that Margaret treated the yellow, bushy-tailed tabby like a mother treats her child. She doted on him, adorning him with the best collars money could buy. And it was even rumored that she fed Tommy caviar instead of kibble. Anyone who knew the Pattersons knew that Tommy lived like a king. Like for themselves, the Pattersons expected nothing less than the best for their cat. Never liking Tommy to be left alone, Margaret often took him with her on her ventures out of the house. Tommy once accompanied Margaret to the photo supply store and went exploring. After he didn't return, the Pattersons quickly placed an ad in the local paper, offering a liberal reward to anyone who could provide information leading to his whereabouts. Margaret had spent over $500, or $4,600 today, on 9-year-old Tommy's medical needs over the course of his life, always making sure Tommy was healthy and happy. When they traveled, Tommy wasn't left alone with a bowl of water and dried kibble, but instead boarded at the D.L. Cady Animal Hospital, where he was treated like royalty. About a month after the Pattersons abruptly left, Miss Nathan Sherwin, The couple's neighbor reported that her son walked in the house and exclaimed, "Mother, Tommy is back." Tommy was thin, disheveled, and nervous. He appeared to have been living a rough existence. The feline was making rounds to several homes in the neighborhood looking for food, and once fed, returned to his home. With the emergence of Tommy, neighbors began wondering and talking, as it was unimaginable that Margaret would, under any circumstance, leave her precious Tommy to fend for himself. Suspicions that the Pattersons hadn't simply gone on vacation began to transpire. If you have any information about the disappearance of William and Margaret Patterson, please contact El Paso County Sheriff's Department at 915-538-2292. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, part 2 of the disappearance of William and Margaret Patterson. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing with a friend, or stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the case and post pictures, so please join in. If you enjoy reading about true crime, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. The True Crime Files covers an assortment of interesting true crime cases, and they're always amazing and well-written. The True Crime Files never disappoints. We would like to thank our newest Patreon contributor, The Unresolved Podcast. The Unresolved Podcast is very well researched and presented flawlessly with compassion. If you haven't subscribed, do so. You'll be glad you did. It's one of our favorites. We would also like to thank Diana Washington Valdez, investigative reporter for the El Paso Times and author of Killing Fields, Harvest of Women. And finally, we would like to thank Richard O. Jones from the True Crime Historian podcast, who contributed his time and his unmistakably awesome voice to this episode. Here's a promo from the True Crime Historian. We think you'll figure out pretty quickly that you've been missing out if you haven't been listening. It's amazing. Thanks, y'all.
True Crime Historian presents classic tales of the scandals, scoundrels, and scourges of the past, told from official documents, the writings of the pioneers of true crime, and newspaper accounts in the golden age of yellow journalism. Whether it's a love triangle turned bad, a heist gone awry, or a fall from grace, they all have one thing in common. Yeah, that's not going to end well. I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, and I give you new stories every Thursday and Sunday from the Wondery Network at www.truecrimehistorian.com or your favorite podcast player.
La ley de la traición. vida. Ya no tienes corazón ni lo regalas. Ya no tienes corazón ni lo regalas. Todo se acaba, mujer, en esta vida. Sepultura.